this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, North Face Fashion Jack, I'm talking about Ricky on the board. S&P futures are up. Well, we'll see how much they're up, because it just flashed off my page. They're not up, they're actually down. But we'll find out how much. They are down 10.50, NASDAQ futures down 58. This is after a little rally yesterday. We've got gold up today. We've got oil. What's oil doing? We got crypto up a little bit again as we continue to manufacture wealth. I love it. Kevin, why didn't we think of that?
I did. It just didn't work when I tried it.
Oh, all right. Well, timing is everything, they say. Whoever the theys are, they. What is it? In the mist, they. There's always somebody up there, right?
Yeah, it is they, and I have a lot of respect for they.
Yeah.
But not for them.
No. As they used to say in the trading floor, when somebody'd say we, who's we? You got a mouse in your pocket? So we were talking a bunch of stuff yesterday regarding, wherever you look, the wealth disparity. I mean, clearly the people in Puerto Rico that are all the Bitcoin people have to be. I mean, they got to be hoping for a bigger bill to light their cigarettes with. The 100's not enough, right? I mean, this wealth bubble thing is really something. And I don't know whether you want it to stop or. You don't like the disparity, but you also don't like to see everybody lose all their money either. So I don't know. I'm just going to sit here and watch. Although, we've had a lot of my clients like to be in gold and so forth, and we've had a real nice week in there. It ran way down. We had some puts. We rolled the puts down, and then we got longer on the way up with a repair strategy, and it ran back up, and it's right back where we started from. But we did pretty well. So. Sometimes the things you do, the protection can actually really work for you, not just be protected. Not all the time, but sometimes. But that's, this is crazy stuff, Kevin. It's up and down, all over the place. I mean, if you have positions that are set up for that, it actually can work out okay, but you really don't like to see it on a long-term basis, this kind of volatility. And you've got, some of it is, I don't know if it's necessarily politics, but it has to do with just where we are in terms of, are we going to pour more money into the system to pay for any kind of tax cut or whatever anybody else people's doing it? I mean, who knows? I mean, these are policy decisions that you get the feeling that government, whoever the government is, doesn't quite get with them. Or one or the other thing, Kevin, they actually do get what they're doing and they're just pumping the hell out of the one percenters. And we talked a lot about with Lou and everybody. I mean, who are these people in the middle? How are you going to, what does your supply chain stuff look like? What if you do decide to, kick in the ass, basically, military procurement, which it looks like. But the article that he sent us yesterday that we were talking about, there's all kinds of stuff in that article. It has to do with maybe taking the time to get together and really plot out the right direction. I mean, for a while it was the two front war. Then it was something else. But what is the new direction? Is it a whole bunch of bee stings all over the place like the Houthis? What does that cost? What's the equipment you're going to use for that? Is it the Chinese have a 90 bazillion ICBMs where I don't care how how stout your carrier battle fleet is, one or two is going to get through it. Or do you just drop a nuke over the whole thing? Is that something, you know, we have, you know, 10 pockets of huge power there and not 20 or not 30 or something else? I mean, it would take a real lot of time, you know, not years, but it would take a lot of time, and I think you'd need some sober people from both houses of Congress in on those meetings. So when it comes down to the budgets and stuff, they're not seeing it for the first time. I mean, this is more your stuff than mine, but I'm just going to try and set the stage. But I would say at the fastest, it's going to be, even if everybody wanted to do it right, and everybody got included and not, you know, people, you know, running around like pompous asses like a lot of politicians like to do on both sides. If you did it right, it's got to be 6 to 8 months to even get a new plan together. And then once you did, assuming it has to change a lot, maybe it doesn't, then where do you get the stuff? Are the places still in business? How much can they ramp up? Can they get the financing? Does the government have to give them all the dough like they do with all these other industries, it seems? Where do they source their stuff? Do you want this? There's going to be 10,000 parts in there. How many of them are coming from essentially what we think to be an enemy, maybe an enemy? I mean, this is a massive project, and it's not just we better get together and do it. It's, I mean, how the hell are you going to do it? I mean, this is like World War II all over again, isn't it?
Well, think of it like this. You know, just to give you an idea of scale, and I, in many ways, it's best left to not be engineered by some kind of government plan. But remember when we had hundreds of cargo ships stacked out in the ocean waiting to get in? You know, just a couple of years ago. So we had stuff couldn't get in. We didn't have the rail capacity to handle it when it did. We had a reallocation of which industries, while everybody was locked at home, we had a reallocation of which industries were actually producing stuff and which weren't, and that showed up in the automotive industry as an example. And so we had this whole, we had this whole disruption of the supply networks. And how long did it take to get back to something that appears to be kind of normal? I still don't think we're all the way back, but, you know, how long did it take to get back to something resembling normal?
Well, I mean, I don't know. People are going to complain no matter what, so I don't know what normal is.
Well, shelves stocked.
Yeah.
No problems getting products that you need. You know, no need to stock up on toilet paper and things like, you know, you can start thinking of all the ways it manifests itself. And so I bring that up to say, okay, if we're going to try to get the defense stockpiles where they need to be, how long is that going to take? And the answer is, we're looking at years. If we start now and just really make a focused effort on it, then we have a long way to go. Now, what's going to happen in the meantime? Does that mean we're really doing is saying, even if we make a really, really great effort to get the stockpiles back where they are, that we get ourselves everything disengaged in Ukraine so that we aren't depleting the stockpiles more, and everything's refocused on the right things, what are we really telling adversaries? Better strike now, because you're not going to have the chance in 5 years. You know.
Well, you still have the.
So in other words, you have to have defense now too.
Well, your fallback position is always, you know, two Ohio class submarines sitting off the coast of China with 500 nuclear weapons on them.
that can be it. But in other words, and I talk about this in a different venue when we're in the classroom and we're dealing with quality issues, that sometimes, I mean, you want to get to your long-term solutions. You want stable systems. You want everything to be working right. But you know what? Sometimes you just have to stop the bleeding. And you know, when you say stop the bleeding in a manufacturing sense, you're probably talking about things like 100% inspection before things go out the door, which is expensive and doesn't add any value to your products. And so you start looking at things like that that you have to do. Well, what does stop the bleeding mean in the military? I don't know. That's a Lou question. That's a Mike Murphy question about what that really means. But there has to be something that addresses where we are today and what our problems are today. And it's really, really hard to get focused on where we need to be in 5 years when you're playing the stop the bleeding game today.
Well, I think just from a management point, not that, you know, I mean, you're giving classes on it, but I think you can't have a think tank of a few people spend 6 months on it, then break the news to the next group, then break the news to the next group, then break the news to Congress. I mean, I think if you're going to do this, somehow, you know, Trump has to become more social or something. I'm not saying he can't. He has to gather these people together in a way where they're dying to get involved, and there needs to be 5 or 10 people from both sides of the aisle, from the Senate to the House, to where when the plan gets together, it hits the Congress essentially sort of prepped and ready to be passed, and not take 2 years in there either. I mean, there's a lot of steps here. I mean, I really think that, I mean, I don't think, I think I know that the preparations for World War II really started in like 1936, maybe 37, when new ships were designed and this, that, and the other thing. And it wasn't the day after Pearl Harbor, like a lot of people think, because a lot of people think a lot of things that aren't true. But I'm sure I think a lot of things are true that aren't. The idea that people can send 50 drones at you and you're firing at it with $1 million missiles that you're delivering two a month, I'm like, whoa. that's a non-starter. Plus, how the hell do you even supply people with these things out in the Red Sea, bobbing and weaving? When, you know, I mean, we have to look at our...
And Lou mentioned some things yesterday that are happening that, you know, that don't get a lot of publicity, but we do have water drones, we do have air drones. They do, you know, I mean, there are some technology shifts in defense that have happened and are happening, and I think those are important as well. You know what? I'm sure, you know, without even taking a dive into it, I have a strong guess that that we got problems. We have problems with sourcing. You know, where are we getting the parts we need to make the kinds of weaponry you need to have a good defense, to make it really a deterrent type of defense, because the lethality is such that it's just not worth it to somebody else to make the attack? Where do we get the parts for that? Well, I hope to God we're not sourcing those out of China.
Well, I mean, the way more Lou and Mike talk about Taiwan, looks to me like if China really wants to screw us, all they do is blockade the place. They don't have to take them over.
Absolutely. You know,
and I hope they're not listening.
I forget the percentage of chips in the world that are made in Taiwan, but it's a big number. So just that alone, just that one product alone, you know, would just be a killer. And, you know, the real question is, how did we let it get that way?
Because people are making...
How did we have so little vision that we let it get that way?
It starts from people going to the store, and you know, I've said this not 100 times, but a few times, because I was pretty tall, not quite as tall. I always bought my clothes kind of from catalogs because they had talls, right? So, you know, Eddie Bauer, and they all kind of degraded along the way, and you have to pick up a new one, right? That's another issue. But Duluth Trading had Made in America blue jeans and khakis for maybe a year and a half. Not anymore. They're about $20 or $25 higher. L.L. Bean, I think, had the same thing. You can go online and you can say Made in America khakis. You know, there's a couple of companies. I never see anybody wearing them. I mean, they're $20 more. You've got people here that are hurting big time, and they go to what's the Gap place, the cheap joint, what's their place where you go get the $10 blue, not $10, but the cheap shirts and everything. Old Navy. Yeah, it's Old Navy, right?
I'll take your word for it. I don't think I've ever set foot in an Old Navy.
I think when I first opened and I looked at it and said, I don't like this place. But anyway, you walk in there and there's the, if you can even find them, the Made in America blue jeans for your five kids that are $100. And you look at the other ones and they're $40 and the kids are crawling around their hands and knees and playing out in the backyard. Which ones do you buy when you don't have it, that much dough? I mean, the one of the problems I see with all the different things, when you guys have your, I mean, obviously our military guys are smarter on that. You're smarter on the supply chain stuff, but I'm seeing a total degradation in the ability of the confidence of people to let the market finance itself. We're talking about, a stock market that for some reason, even though it's, well, people think it's not a stock, but it is, Bitcoin. All of a sudden, here's a place with none of the same rules of anything else, and all of a sudden it's going to trade $100,000. It's worth $1.8 trillion of made up money. In my, you can say about, you know, whatever the system and all that crap, it has nothing to do with anything. It has to do with this as an artificial stock. Now, there's $1.8 trillion, yet it seems like every company now, if we're going to have a chip manufacturer, we don't trust the markets to raise that capital for somebody, either through the bond market or through the stock market or something. The question is, why not? That's what it's there for. And the people who gleefully trade stock all day, and, you know, there's a lot of my clients, stuff, and they don't, the entire reason for a secondary stock market, the entire reason why I manage people money doing this stuff is because if people go out and raise money for a stock and it becomes a new company, people who own the stock can sell it on the open market and it's liquid and it makes the company more valuable. That's the reason for the stock market. It's not for people to play games up and down the thing. And obviously, people do that, and I love to do it. But the reason for stock options is protection. You know, it can be used for a lot of leverage and a lot of bad things, but it's for protection or for maybe getting a little more income when you decide where you think you want to sell a stock. There's basic principles here, Kevin. I don't think any. Why now does every single person that's going to start one of these businesses? Well, you got two things going for you. I don't trust the government, and say the government meaning, I mean, you know, Trump put a lot of this stuff in motion, but he's not the only one. I mean, would I go out and do all the, you know, the road shows and all the stuff I need to do to raise capital for a company for a big metalworking, or what do you call the stuff that goes in computers and aren't chips, all the little pieces, the little transformers and all that stuff? Would I possibly put my neck on the line to go and do that, not knowing whether the next guy is going to increase the tariffs, decrease the tariffs, ignore the tariffs, decide China's our friend, all of a sudden they're our enemy? How could I possibly? That's why I want to go to government and get my money, my nose up their ass, to get for them to give me the money. We don't trust the market, like you mentioned earlier. Didn't say it the same way. But we don't trust our institutions here to do what they're supposed to do. And I think we still can. But if somebody else is going to give somebody else an advantage for free, why would you and I ever think of opening up a chip business if the government is going to give, who do you guys give it? Was it in Columbus or someplace? Even how many bazillion dollars in the place up in Kenosha? Why would we ever try and compete with that person?
Well, you wouldn't. There have been companies that have sprung up that have come up with some really innovative types of chips and semiconductors. So there have been, but they get gobbled up pretty quickly. Here's our number. About 18% of the global semiconductor manufacturing capacity is in Taiwan, but about 92% of the most advanced chip capacity is located in Taiwan. Looking back at 2021 is a number I have, about 44% of U.S. imports of logic chips were manufactured in Taiwan. That's logic chips compared to 24.4% of U.S. imports of memory chips and 1% of U.S. imports.
Well, what's the difference between a logic chip and a memory chip?
What they do. Don't get hung up on it, other than to say the point of it, Tom, is those are big numbers. That even if you were looking at, let's go back to the worldwide capacity, even when you're saying, well, it's 18%, disrupt that. Disrupt that with weather, with a tsunami or something like that. Forget war, forget China. Disrupt that with a tsunami and say, what's going to happen to the market if you knock out basically almost 20% of its capacity for any extended period of time? You're kind of screwed.
I have a question.
Because now everybody's scrambling to reorganize the market and to try and get their hands on what they need instead of what anybody else over anybody else.
I have a real stupid question. Maybe where the hell's Russell? Maybe he would know. If we talk about a chip plant here, it's billions of dollars. It's the government condemning property, putting it in a place, and all this crap. How the hell did Taiwan get all that dough to do all that stuff for these places? Is it a question of the process is dirtier over there and we have to be clean? I mean, where did they get all the dough to do all this stuff?
Interesting question. Not one I am capable of answering because I haven't looked at the history of it. It's been that way for a long time. Taiwan Semiconductor has been up and running for a really, really long time. So it may be, you can start having a chicken and egg conversation about did they get up and running when nobody else was making it, or did they get up and running and had a cost advantage for whatever reason that systematically we diverted the capacity over to there? And I don't know. That's a little bit of a historical analysis that I haven't done.
If I had a guess, it'd be answer B.
Yeah, probably the latter. Most likely, because things don't happen with the snap of a finger very often.
I talk to my nephew every week and about what's going on in his firm, because obviously I'm concerned about him and I want him to have a job and a promotion and those kinds of things. And I use that information for the show because it's a spot of middle America. These guys are kind of right in the middle of they're not making machines, but they're making parts for machines, and they're making stuff for people that go into factories. I mean, Pullman had all kinds of, they had many different people that supplied them. I mean, they didn't make the nuts and bolts. They didn't make the welding, what do you call the welding stuff? There's a million different kinds of welding flex rods, right? All the different chemicals in there. It's quite the science, actually. I never really understood, other than it was way above my pay grade. But there was Bloomer Fist that made, anytime Pullman didn't want to make a part, they made it for him. The guy was always there. What do you need from us? And there are other people. It becomes almost an organism, when you have some place like that, because there's this constant, should we buy the machine? Should we buy it from somebody else who already got the machine? It's almost like, what did Hillary say? It takes a neighborhood or a town to raise a kid.
She said it takes a village, but
whatever.
I hate to quote Hillary Clinton in anything.
Well, but the point being, it really takes an awful lot of places to do this stuff. Now, are you going to give the semiconductor place $90 bazillion? Do they want to have it all in house? What if you and I put up a place across the street that makes some of the whatever the parts would be? Are we going to get financing, or are we on their own? Now, can we compete with these people? Actually,
I'm sure our politicians, thought all of this through and have acted with extreme foresight.
Well, I mean, what if Pullman was just selling cars to people? Okay, so what if, they actually, went to Washington, put their teary face on, greased the right people, and they got a big stuff for doing this. Well, how the hell could Bloomer Fisk ever compete with Pullman if Pullman was getting money from the government for the new machines and parts and everything? Well, you disrupt the whole thing when you start doing this stuff, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
everything you do is, it's going to have an effect through the network, and which is fine. I think there's an understanding of that. The fallacy, or the folly is probably a better word, is to think that you have complete control over it. And the answer to that is, I don't think so. Some things are just going to unfold how they unfold, and there isn't a damn thing you can do about it. So if we, you know, it's it, this is why engineering everything like that, you know, is so difficult to do, because it's exactly what you said. If I want to build a, you know, if I want to be a supplier to the foundry, you know, am I going to get some money to go do that? Because that's so important as well. And, you know, that requires some planning, some forethought for how that's supposed to work. And, you know, it's just not going to happen. I said things, you know, networks evolve as much as they act according to a plan.
Without a doubt, there's always going to be somebody more efficient at something, even if you're putting together an airplane. I mean, Boeing doesn't make every single part there because other people are more efficient at making some of them there. So
the question gets to be, and I haven't really thought about this that very much, but if you have a strategic industry like that, I mean, we've seen this with Boeing. We want to protect Boeing because we need to have an airline industry in this company or in this country. And oh crap, it's not going that well. You know, what's the real way to go about doing that? Because you definitely do want to, you know, you want to juice the process. You want it to happen. We're talking about, you know, God, what is it, like a $1 billion or more to get one up and running, more like multiple, probably closer to $10 billion. And, you know, 5 years to build it, and then I don't know how long after that to get it to any kind of capacity. You know, we are looking at, you know, a really long lead time to get anything going. How do you make it happen fast? How do you make it happen in some kind of orderly fashion without turning it into, I just threw a whole bunch of money at Intel, and 6 months later they're laying off thousands of people?
Well, I'm not so sure that when you put the where's the new place? It's in Arizona, right? Somebody's making some kind.
Well, one of them is. Yeah, they're maybe supposedly several of them in the works.
I think you might be putting together a place so big that you're talking about everything from soup to nuts, and you're not relying on other people just springing up and doing bits and pieces of it like you would, like we did at Pullman or like Boeing does. Maybe you're essentially locking everybody out that the new semiconductor plant is going to do everything. I don't know, why is that efficient? Why don't you I don't know how many parts go into those boards and stuff, or anybody else can do any of this stuff. Probably they can. Why not get somebody saying, we're going to assemble them and we're going to make these pieces, but the other guys are going to do the other stuff? I mean, I don't know how you even, one of the things that always comes back to haunt, I think, and everybody knows it probably to their nauseam, you know, I harp on this antitrust. I gotta ask Lou if he can find it again, Kevin. When he sent around the combinations in the defense industry since, what was it, 1960, 1970, somewhere in there? Might have been 70. The amount of companies that no longer exist, they got sucked up. I mean, we're not talking about just Boeing having to feed their sorry ass. We're talking about Boeing probably has, what, 15 companies there that used to be independent? Maybe not 15, but... I mean, how many people does Lockheed have that used to be other places? How many people does Honeywell have that used to be other places? I mean, how many people? I mean, we're talking about five or six people now that are totally dominating the industry, the business, that industry.
Yeah. Have you heard any discussion in political campaigns about, you know, how what policy is going to be for these kinds of consolidations when they asked to get approval for the mergers or for the acquisitions? Was there a lot of discussion? There may have been in the background, but there sure as hell wasn't anything out there for voters like you and me to assess. And even if there were, you know, would people have paid any attention? Because we, you know, it might have diverted attention away from what the Kardashians are doing.
Well, I mean, one thing I will say that I absolutely predicted 100% in this campaign, presidential campaign, is not one thing that we've ever talked about on this show that people on this show, and are pretty smart people, even though we argue all the time, thought was important. Not one of those things was discussed in the campaign. So I got that going for me. I don't get a prize for that, Kevin. But I mean, but the question now, what do you do? You can't break McDonnell Douglas back out of Boeing and say we really need two people competing here, can you? How can you?
if you were to do such a thing, if you were inclined to do such a thing, you would, you know, there would certainly have to be some planning and some orderliness behind it, which, you know, ain't going to happen. And now we say we have to break them up. What happened when we broke up the phone companies, the Bells?
Well, I mean, I'm not...
We're right back where we were.
Well, okay, but I get that part. But, you know, maybe... But the fact is, we would like more than five or six main suppliers. We used to have that. Now, we can't go back in time and spin it all back. That part I get. But the resistance to any kind of change like this... I just heard anecdotally on the way in here. Not anecdotally, I was listening to it. Evidently, Senator Durbin yesterday came up with some idea regarding minor league baseball and essentially breaking up the monopoly in minor league baseball. And immediately, I don't know why people got to shove their nose up the ass of baseball. They like it the way it is. They like the draft. They like all this stuff. All of a sudden, they've got people on there saying what a horrible idea it is. One guy was on there talking about it's going to end up with less people in the minor leagues. Durbin was talking about something like, these guys at least ought to make minimum wage, for God's sake. Something along those lines. And have some sort of, you know, workman's comp and things. I think that's all he said immediately thereafter. Oh, no, it's going to ruin our baseball. What do you mean ruin your baseball? It's a freaking monopoly. I mean, I don't get it, Kevin. People love to go out and get bleep-faced watching the NFL draft. I can't think of anything more un-American in my life than a draft for people. I mean, really? I'm not going to solve these issues, but Durbin, he didn't have it out of his mouth yesterday, and people are all over him about it. Oh, no, it's perfect the way it is. No, it's not. Is it? In one man's opinion.
I live in a minor league town. I think it's highly entertaining. The small ballpark, kind of the schmaltiness of some of the promotions and all of that, but no, is it perfect the way it is? No. I don't know what the system should be for that, because it is a way for baseball to develop its talent, and frankly, it's still more honest. It still has more integrity than doing it through the colleges.
I don't disagree, but I'm saying do baseball and football need to be a monopoly? Does anybody really believe that baseball is not interstate commerce? I mean, there can't be anybody that's stupid. Yet that's a Supreme Court decision that they're right, that is the base of their monopoly.
Yeah, baseball is not interstate commerce, but health insurance is.
Yeah, I mean the question is: do we trust our systems? And does everybody who does anything now need a carve out from the system? I mean, somebody's going after Google to break. What do they want to split it off into? What they want to take the search engine. What is the split in Google that cut the stack down the other day? You know more about Google than I do.
Paid no attention to it at all.
They're trying to split.
I've had kind of a week of.
Oh, you're busy.
Of rather, yeah. I had about 10 program reviews to do.
I'll tell you the state of our world, Kevin. And this is what this building we're in downtown. We've been here 20 years, and it's not the world's best building, but it's home, and the people here we really like. And one of the guys I always talk about, my buddy Salvador, he's one of the janitor, building engineers, whatever you want to call it. An absolutely terrific guy. Terrific guy. Gives me a real, you know, finger on the pulse of the Hispanic community and so forth. And you talk to him about Mexico. So the building now, it's owned by this guy, and who's now given the building to his daughter, because the guy is 90-something. Daughter lives in Wisconsin and, like, never wants to come here. Okay. So she hires some management company. So yesterday they fire everybody. And when I talk about everybody, Salvador, Alex, the two building engineer guys, Salvador's two daughters who come here at night for 10 years and clean all the offices at night, they fire them. Now, how the hell do you...
Why did they fire them? Are they going out of business? Or
No. They get a list. They have a service. The service pays people a lot less. And they're going to give them, I don't even think, they're going to give them an opportunity to work six more weeks, not even 6 weeks severance. Guy's been here 24 years. He's getting no severance. So they're going to give him an opportunity next week with a reference to interview with the new service company that they pay a lot less. So the guy makes, I think he makes like $22 an hour or something like that, 23 maybe. But here's the crux, is what these people are so stupid they don't understand is if a toilet goes out, these two guys fix it. They don't have to call the plumber for $200 an hour downtown. They totally are missing that piece of it. So in their attempt to screw everybody, they're actually screwing themselves, I think. But I am so used to leaving money, checks on my desk or something when I knew the place was being clean, knowing it's his daughter's, nothing's ever missing, you never have to worry about anything. Now what? Am I going to want a different person in my office every night for cleaning up and stuff? I don't want that. I'm not going to move because of it. Why are people out of all...
I have a question for you about that. And this is sort of a gear shift here in a different direction. But do you know who the company is that's coming in?
I have no idea. They just hired somebody.
Well, because this sort of smacks of the situation we saw in Springfield, Ohio. What they do... is they have these non-government organizations that hire people who are in the country illegally, and they, you know, it's part of the arrangement that they have with the government, and so they will be effectively the employment agency at below market rates for them, and they take a skin, they take a piece of everything they pay. So, let's just say your guy was making $20 an hour, and they'll bring in people who get, you know, for 12, and of course they'll take 4.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And the people who are in the migrants, illegal migrants, will get paid 8. And see, they're doing fine. They're above minimum wage. Isn't that great?
Well, you know, it comes down to if
you how much you want to bet that's what we're going to see.
I'm sure. Well, I think you're going to have, instead of somebody has to sit on top and say, you can't just say, geez, Salvador, that sink leaks, and the guy just fixes it because he loves the work. Rather, now we're going to have to file, you know, some kind of a form with somebody who's not even in the building, and maybe a week from now they fix the sink. But now that guy has to look at it. He has to do something else. And the guy they're paying to fix the sink is, why don't just get it done by the guy who's here? I think there's in the amazing attempt to screw people, I think you end up screwing yourself sometime. Just saying. But, I mean,
yeah, so they may cost themselves a lot of money by saving money.
You wonder what the story is when people, there's no loyalty anywhere, and why companies think that people owe them loyalty. I have no idea. I mean, I don't get it, Kevin. I don't understand this new way of doing things. I mean, the chances of me, if I bought a building, firing a guy who's been there 30 years that everybody likes and does his job properly, why would I ever even think of doing that? Yeah, I guess that's why. What does it say at our commercial? That's why we're sitting here. Nobody gave us $1 million or something, right? I mean, I don't these layers and layers of management where people don't do anything. It's you know, I don't know. I mean, the best one I ever saw was the guy who, after Hurricane Katrina, that's the first time I ever saw the huge extent of the, what's the term? The outsourcing or subcontracting, and this is when we just started the show, didn't we? Katrina came through. Anyway, one of the listeners sent me this thing, an article about somebody had got this contract out of Washington to go clean up, you know, the street. I mean, the streets are all full of crap, right? Because everything came over and all the houses, the sofas and everything else are all just laying in the street. And so some guy gets a contract in Washington. He subcontracted it out. And that guy subcontracted it out. When he got to the bottom, it was like the fifth firm, and you had a guy with a big dump truck and three people that were illegals with brooms throwing the stuff in the dump truck. And there were four people in the middle. I mean, when that stuff starts to happen, you got to almost like tear your hair out and say, well, what are we doing? You know, it's one thing. I mean, I think I know enough about the world where there's always going to be a little something. Everybody's got to wet their beak. World War II, did the guy making the PT boats on the Chicago River here, You know, did he get a contract where he got 5% more of maybe 10% more than he should have? I don't know. Maybe. But he's spent it in the neighborhood. Maybe paid up a little bit for the engine somewhere other place, and you know, drank at the same bar that maybe you and I would drink in. It wasn't like he made so much money. He goes, I'm not going to build these things. I'm going to hire some other schmuck to build them. I'm just going to sit here. I mean, that's a whole new level, isn't it?
Well, it is. Yeah, it's just layering on the graft. That's all. Let's look at it this way. We're hiring the people that do the work, but they have to pay tribute, just like in the mafia.
Well,
they got to kick up to the bosses.
When I told you a story before, I'll keep it real brief. When the two or three Dan Ryan resurfaces or rebuilding ago Dan Ryan Expressway in Chicago, I think we were, I had not been to school board yet, so it had to be after senior year of high school. It had to be. And they had the hiring place where you went if you wanted to get hired as a laborer. And at that time, it was $8.50 an hour or something, which is a lot of dough. I mean, we're talking 1970. And so we're waiting. And there's all these black guys, right? So, of course, I immediately strike up a friendship with the one dude. And guy's got a family. Nice guy. And I'm thinking, this guy deserves the job more than I do. I mean, if he gets it instead of me, I'm not going to be all that upset about it, because I'm just some schmuck going to school trying to make beer money. And so then this other guy comes by bragging away, well, I'm part of the coalition. And I'm thinking, okay, what exactly is a coalition? Well, the coalition was some, you know, community, you know, big mouth that somehow got himself between the hiring piece and the person getting hired. And this, you know, this goes back a ways. And so they ended up, we're not hiring today, come back tomorrow. We're not hiring today, come back tomorrow. So after about 4 days of this, they meet on a Sunday night secretly, and they hire only the people that were part of the coalition. So I asked the nice guy, I go, are you in this coalition? He goes, no, I'm not in the coalition. He says, I'm probably not going to get anywhere with this. And I said, well, what do those guys get exactly? He goes, well, the $8.50 an hour, you got to kick them back a buck to the organizer to get you in the door. So it's not new, Kevin, but it sucks.
So, yeah, so, but, you know, one man's coalition is the other's this thing of ours.
Yeah. Meanwhile, regular people just couldn't get hired. It couldn't do a random way. I don't know, it probably wouldn't be correct, but I would say anybody who's got a family, you get in line first, but, you know, and I wouldn't be in the line. But if there was ways to do it, it sure as hell wouldn't have been by color. It would have been maybe been by need. Anyway, but I'm saying this stuff is not new. And you know, a lot of buildings downtown here, they're all being run now by other companies because these buildings are in such bad shape. There's these management companies that say they can run it cheap, and they basically take it out on the employees and grab the cream like you're talking about. But it's every building now. The Board of Trade has got management companies, all these places, because there's nobody... They're not doing well enough to have their own organization in the building like they used to have, where you had a management office and you might have a guy who runs it and a couple of ladies that took complaints, and they don't have to be ladies. You got a few guys that worked in the place that have been there 30 years that know where every bolt and every switch is. You don't have that anymore.
Well, and Tom, I'm not appalled by having hiring a third party to do it. People who can focus on certain kinds of work. And, you know, if you're saying, well, is the Board of Trade expert in how to maintain a building? No, not really. And, they have no idea if it's being well managed or not. Okay, I get that. I just don't want the grift that goes with it. And that's my bigger problem. Industries are going to, you know, they're going to shake out in different ways. And that's just the way it is. But this idea that it gets tied into, going back to our original conversation, that it gets tied into government and how we go about doing work. And that's why I said this one smacks of having that third-party NGO in there doing it instead of a normal employment agency type of situation or a normal third-party situation where what they're really doing is providing a more efficient move in terms of how you get the service. I suspect that what we're really doing is we're laundering low salaries or low wages through a third-party company.
I think that's what we're doing, too. And I wonder, Kevin, I wish I had the history of this. There's got to be a book someplace. I mean, I mentioned a few times that we, the U.S. of A, actually started doing stuff. All those guys are dead. I can't even ask them. But when Pullman started making tanks and so forth.
You can ask them all you want, Tom.
They're not going to answer. When Pullman started making tanks and so forth for the Brits, and because they had a huge plant, they probably didn't stop making railroad cars, but they probably turned over some of the production of the tanks. And they actually made a landing craft, too. They used to test out in Lake Calumet, of all places. When that started to happen in, say, 36, 37, 38, where do you suppose that funding came from? Because the stock markets were in disarray. I mean, Pullman had money. I mean, George Pullman always had money, but he was still alive then. But you wonder, was that internally financed? Did the government give them money? Or because they had plants going and they already had the overhead cranes and stuff, it wasn't that big of a capital-type thing. It was, instead of building a railroad car, you're building a tank. What's the difference? We'll give you the money for that. I mean, maybe it just was that simple because the capacity was already there. But, you know, but there had to be places, you know, for Ford to put in some huge building that built, what, they built B-24s or something? That money had to come from somewhere. I mean, did it come from the markets, or did the government do that? Or I think people somehow financed it either themselves or through the markets.
Well, or they made contracts with the government that allowed them to, you know, to, yeah, maybe finance it themselves, but maybe do it at a guaranteed profit, you know, at a guaranteed margin. Again, I don't know. I am not the historian.
Well, because we're looking, really, the theme of this conversation is we're kind of looking for something like that, aren't we? I mean, we don't need...
Yeah, I think that would be ideal, if you really, really were concerned about microchips, so let's go back to chips, semiconductors, et cetera, and say we're really, really concerned about that. Where is our biggest concern? What industries are of the biggest concern? So, if I'm going to get an operation up and running, and it's going to cost me billions, and it's going to take me years, what am I going to do to mitigate the risk? I suppose I can make a contract with the government for military uses. I suppose I can make a contract with GM and Ford for purchases. But are people really doing contracts for 7 years out?
Probably not. Well, I mean, that's not even...
Sure as hell ain't doing it very often.
No,
so the alternative is we just give them money and let them squander it.
Well, I mean, you wonder...
Or we give them money and we put all kinds of conditions about them, you know, having to do the DEI hires that go with it. And say you can't have the money unless you follow these following guidelines, and that's built in. That's part of this deal.
Well, it is part of some of the deals. Yeah, I just wonder what I mean. The chip stuff, I have the feeling, even though I really wouldn't know a chip from my nose, that's pretty high, seriously high you know, high end production of some kind. But it makes you wonder. I mean, Carl could probably name, say, 50 parts that go into a missile, a car, you know, probably the same kind of crap, that aren't chips. They're just some sort of relays or some sort of switches, you name it, that somehow is sourced overseas. And if he or somebody gave us a list of 50 of these things, and we got two or three engineers in there to know what the hell they were talking about, not me, said, okay, well, what do we have to do to get a building or two buildings where we can produce this kind of stuff? It's not...
We can produce the right kind of nuts and bolts.
Yeah, I mean, you know?
Let's keep it as simple as we can here.
Yeah, do the people in Taiwan or China, they have such a huge advantage where we're buying it from them for $2, and the best we can do here is $5 if we pay somebody even minimum wage? I mean, does anybody even know? I mean, how far away we are from this stuff, or is
well, it... the companies individual businesses that source overseas, that source in places like China and, and there are more getting away from that, but you know, that they're not necessarily bringing it home, but they're bringing it elsewhere from China, but let's just call it the Far East and call it a deal. If you have a low-wage country, then it's just, whether you do it or not, becomes a math equation where you're just saying, okay, I have to pay to ship it here. That costs extra versus, you know, having something, you know, built within 100 miles of where I am. But it's worth it to me to pay the extra for shipping because the production cost is so low. Okay, that's fine. You know, you can do that. You can do that if you want. But, you know, Lou had mentioned that they're starting to do a lot more stuff with 3D printing. And what he means is, you think of 3D printing as that, you know, that device that you have, you know, in your basement or in your rec room or something, making, you know, fun little toys of various kinds. But what he's really talking about is that when they talk about it at a higher scale or higher volume, additive manufacturing, where you can make seriously, durable products out of interesting alloys, and you can make them lighter, and you can, you know, there's all kinds of things you can do with that kind of technology. And I think that's got to be part of the equation too, Tom. That we are doing things, we're taking advantage of what we can do technologically to bring the production costs down, to improve functionality of whatever it is, or durability of whatever it is that we need. And that shift has to happen as well. That's again the kind of thing that doesn't just happen at snap of a finger.
How many people in Washington, you know, your party or wherever, somebody else's party that's still there and won't be in a couple of weeks, how many people this morning over coffee and wherever the hell they drink their coffee out there have had this conversation? Any?
Probably more in the manufacturing world than you think.
I mean, I'm talking about the politicians and the people running around doing all this stuff.
Well, you know, some of them know, some of them are just dumbasses.
Does seem like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are some smart people in there. There are some people who, you know, who know, you know, what policy can be or needs to be. But yeah, we have a high coefficient of stupidity too.
Yeah, we have a few minutes left. I'm watching the, well, what's I asked you on Wednesday? What's the song when? Oh, a 3D printer, is that just the same thing as the replicator in the Enterprise?
Just like it, yeah. You tell it Earl Grey hot, and you get your tea in about 10 seconds.
Yeah. Anyway, I look at Indiana ranked number 5th. Somehow, to me, is the most topsy-turvy thing in the world. We had a discussion last night. I mean, how do they get that kind of depth? I mean, when you talk about Indiana, Georgia, Clemson, even Notre Dame, Michigan, Ohio State. Notre Dame probably isn't in that group, really, but their entire roster, which used to be their roster when people couldn't leave, at least 2-star recruits, 3, 4, once in a while there'd be a 5 in there. They have 60, 70 people at that level. Indiana never even was on that playing field. I mean, I'm going to say 10 years ago, if you had 2 3-star recruits on the Indiana team, it would be a banner year. I'm not saying they're schmucks. They're not. They just never played in that pond to any real extent. How good? And I look at Notre Dame, and they're ranked 6th, and yet I've watched them play. They're not that good. The defense is, they're not bad. They're you know, getting better coached. They got some standout players. But
are you kidding? Their defense is hell on wheels. They're really good.
I just said that. I've tried, but I'm saying.
Oh, okay, I thought you said the defense is, and then you sort of said I'm not that.
No. But no, the defense is exceptionally good. But what I'm saying, it seems to me, after watching the teams that never used to lose, that I don't think any of these teams are as good as they were 3-4 years ago. I don't think any of them have the depth, because Alabama doesn't have 80 people anymore. Because they're all gone. They went somewhere else to play. I mean,
yeah, so what you have to do, I mean, and I will tell you the interesting thing, because you mentioned Notre Dame, is they have a lot of depth. They've had a whole bunch of injuries on the defense, and they just keep rolling guys out there from the younger classmen. They've you know, they've recruited, especially on defense, they've recruited very well. And you notice that they're pretty deep at running back as well.
Oh, yeah.
And their line has come along despite a whole series of injuries at the beginning of the season. You know, so now if they just get a quarterback who could pass accurately, they'd be something. But the reason I say that is, so the first thing is you have to be fortunate. You can't suffer injuries in the wrong places. So it, you know, in Indiana's case, let me just take a quick look at their passing stat.
But I'm just saying, there's 60-man roster, can't be Ohio State.
No, it's not. But they only need the guys on the field to be competitive with Ohio State. And I don't know if they will be. I think Ohio State will probably win. But Indiana does have a great equalizer in that you're looking at a quarterback whose completion percentage is about 72%, and he's got 21 touchdown passes, and he's, you know, so 21 touchdown passes, only 4 interceptions. Well, especially in college football, but in any football, if you have the best quarterback, you're going to be competitive unless you just can't block for him, Chicago Bears.
Yeah.
So that's a huge equalizer for this fellow Curtis O'Rourke. And I don't know anything about him because I really haven't seen Indiana play much this year. But damn, he's having a season, isn't he?
Yeah, well, I'm just saying.
He's a senior. He's a fifth-year guy. He's a Canadian, so when he barks out the signals, he goes, hot one, eh?
Hey, hoser, eh? You think he barks out a hoser? It just seems, Kevin, is all the stuff that I look at, it doesn't seem a whole lot of logic. We're draining people of their depth through the NIL, and at the same time, we're adding more, not just games, but meaningful games. Are we going to end up every year with a TCU situation where they got a really good team, they play well, and they had the halfback who was spectacular and they had a couple guys on defense? All of them get hurt the week before. When they show up at Georgia, it might have been Loyola showing up against her. Is Indiana going to make it through one round of the playoffs? Somebody knocks out this quarterback, and the next week it's 50-0 or something. I mean,
see with Florida State last year? They didn't even get invited to the 4-team playoff because their quarterback got hurt.
Yeah,
and they were undefeated.
And I look at them this year.
Oh my God, are they horrible this year?
I mean, so how many people did this coach bring into him in Indiana? You have any idea?
I think a lot. The quarterback's a transfer. He played at Ohio University. You look at a lot of teams, and they'll be telling you that that there's 20 guys or more, 20 to 30 guys who transferred in, and then there's other teams that maybe only have 4 or 5.
How did the Irish we're cripping on Carl in a second, but I'm sure he's on. How did the Irish linebacker Kaiser, the captain?
Yeah.
How the hell does a guy play 64 games in college?
They have the COVID year.
It still doesn't make it to 64. So
Kaiser played a whole lot when he was a freshman.
I watched the game with JD. Was saying there was somebody he was watching the game. The guy was in his ninth year. He was a COVID. Then he redshirted
and
something else.
Crazy about some guy in his ninth year, but he obviously did not play all of those years.
His coach left, and. How soon? I mean, you've always said,
and they'll give you they'll stop the clock if you join the military. They'll stop the clock if you go on a Mormon mission. There's some things that come into play there.
A lot of times where you and I are arguing, it's about you're on the side of what things ought to be, and I'm looking at them going, how soon are you going to be able to recruit a guy during the year? In basketball, it's almost like it's pretty close, isn't it? If you find a guy who hasn't played his first game yet?
Well, apparently, yeah. Russell told that story. So, once you step on the court, though, then you can transfer. You just can't play for that team that year. once you played for another team. So they don't let you play for two teams in the same year. They don't let you play in a game.
Well, because football is sort of you know, I'll use the term insulated, because it's basically all in the fall quarter, fall semester.
Yeah, it all happens in the
month. But basketball, you could conceivably change teams and show up for the NCAA tournament, isn't that in the spring quarter? If you all of a sudden hurt some other place,
you could.
And you couldn't do it. And you couldn't do it in Notre Dame
if they let you play right away. But yeah, if you already played for one team and you cross into a different semester, you can't play. That was tested a few years ago.
But I'm saying,
a couple years back.
I'm saying in basketball, if somebody got nicked or something in an exhibition game, and some other team was looking for a guy for the NCAA tournament, they were in a quarter system, he could transfer and play in a tournament, couldn't he?
He probably could. You know, the other thing that comes into play is, can you integrate the guy into your lineup at the last second? And I think that's actually harder to do in basketball than it is in football.
It depends on how good you are.
Yeah, well, it does depend on how good you are, but
or how tall you are.
What I'm saying is, a lot of what happens over the course of a basketball season is how a team comes together and becomes more coordinated. And you know, I watch this every year because I go to all the games. So, I think it's one of the more fascinating things about covering a team is not, you know, the individual games are cool, the wins are great, but how the season unfolds and how things come together over the course of a season is interesting. But when you inject somebody in there, and this includes players coming back from injuries, there's always an adjustment period where you're reallocating playing time and you're redefining, you know, the roles. That person who was your big rebounder isn't such a big rebounder anymore, so that person's got to redefine the role. And you know, it isn't necessarily a just, yeah, sign them up, throw them in there.
Well, I think it also...
Unless you got Will Chamberlain.
Well, I mean, it also depends. We're going to promise Carl will be in a second. I mean, if the Bulls have, you know, five guards. So, yeah, if you threw a star guard in there, it's a massive change. If you gave him a center, they don't have a center. He plays tomorrow, right? I mean,
he plays tomorrow, but it's not gonna look good for a while. And so you're not going to throw somebody in right before the NCAA tournament.
If it was Wilt,
you don't have the grace to not look good for a while.
If it was Wilt, you'd find a spot for him.
Yeah, I'd say then it better be Wilt Chamberlain. Yes,
it is amazing how people. We had the discussion the other night, as usual, over a beer or two, about, you know, different people and how the average American or anybody, I think, still has very little idea, and I have a little bit of an idea because I played sports my whole life, so did you, of how good these people are compared to regular people. And the idea to say somebody like sucks in the NBA, he doesn't suck.
just go as an adult and play against an all-state high school basketball player.
Yeah, I mean,
forget college.
Yeah, forget pros. I mean, you look at, I mean, a guy like Will Chamberlain is the absolute top of the gene pool. A guy like him, or a guy like Gale Sayers, or, you know, those kinds of people. I mean, O.J. Simpson. I mean, how do you find a guy that big, that fast? I mean, how many people, A, are that fast, and A, are that, and B, are that big, and put it in the same person? It's what, one out of how many, a million? It's not even 100,000. Anyway, Kevin, have a nice weekend. Tomorrow night, it'd be kind of a fun game to go, Yankee Stadium, I think.
It might be, yeah. Actually, NBC doubleheader again, just like they had the basketball against Georgetown, followed immediately by Notre Dame football. Tomorrow we have Notre Dame women's basketball, I think at 4 Eastern. This will be 3 for you, followed by the game in Yankee Stadium. And, you know, I know a lot of people don't pay much attention to women's basketball. A lot more have with the, you know, the big Caitlin Clark effect. I will tell you that if you watch Notre Dame against Southern California, you will see 4 of the best 5 players in women's college basketball on the court at the same time, 2 on each side.
Are we thinking if Carl ever went to one of those Tennessee games that he'd somehow screw up and he'd be wearing orange in the white section or white in the orange section?
Don't think so.
You saying you'd have the right color on?
Oh, well, you know, if I was at one of those games, yeah, I would.
Carl is a smart dude. He knows to wear a shirt that's white, and then if he turns it inside out, he can make it orange.
See, you know, they don't make those anymore. Remember those shirts? Carl, I don't know if you were, we went to school. Every school for intramurals, Champion made them. They were double thick T-shirts.
Oh yeah, I know.
Nobody makes those anymore.
No, they don't exist anymore.
How can that be?
I you're asking me. I don't know.
But those people,
because everybody plays shirts and skins now. So
I guess.
I think,
you know, to accommodate Carl, we just need to make the Tennessee crowd go shirts and skins.
Well, in Notre Dame, it was blue on one side,
which would be a whole lot of fun.
plus those
if it's co-ed shirts and skins works for me.
Co-ed shirts and skins ought to be a lot of fun.
God. I had a buddy.
All right, guys, I will be listening.
Carl, I had a buddy when we'd take a trip, and we always go find a place to play basketball. He'd only bring like two T-shirts, so immediately when you picked up sides, he'd say, "We got to be skins." Right. He didn't have another shirt.
Well, you know. So hey, so how about this last couple days? You know, markets and then, you know, all this drama with Gates and the incoming Trump administration. Now Pam Bondi. Do you remember who Pam Bondi is?
I have no idea.
Okay, so Pam Bondi is a former prosecutor from Florida. Okay, you remember this gentleman? I use the word loosely, by the name of Trayvon Martin, right? Used to romp the earth and now romps the daisies from the bottom. Pam Bondi attempted to illegally, I might add, suppress all sorts of evidence and railroad Zimmerman straight into prison. She failed at it, but she took quite a serious attempt at doing that. And I know an awful lot about this case because at the time it happened, I was an executive committee member of the Libertarian Party in the state of Florida, and we had a candidate in that district where the event happened.
Did you have to be an executive to be on the executive committee?
Well, you know, you just have to win an election,
which is,
you know, well, it's an elected position, okay? And that's, you know, I won election. We had a guy who was running for a public seat in that district, okay, where it occurred. And he was adamant that Zimmerman needed to go to jail right now. Now, you'd think that a libertarian would be a little bit slightly interested in due process of law. No, this guy was not. I put a censure motion and a disavowal. Politics is kind of weird. I can run as a Democrat. You can't stop me. Okay. So if you want to stop me, the only way you can do it is to run another candidate, essentially primary me, force me to win in a primary. But you don't have to support me as a party because free speech works always.
But you have to get signatures of people who are allegedly Democrats, right?
No, actually, I just have to get signatures of
signature anybody. Okay, in a district,
they have to be registered voters in the district.
Okay.
Okay, so, and that is checked when you turn the petitions in.
Oh, God, yeah, they check it. They're all over that.
Oh, God, yeah. And you know, I mean, when we used to do these, we would always, you know, you had to make sure you had some extras because, you know, if the qualifying amount was, say, 2,000 petitions, right? If you showed up with 2,000 petitions, you were almost certainly going to get bounced because there'd be somebody who would sign one that wasn't actually a registered voter in that district.
They'd look for it, they'd boot you. But if you had 10, they'd be too lazy to do it, so they'd say, go ahead.
Well, if the requirement was, say, 2,000, you better show up with 2,200. You better have about a 10% margin on your petitions, because if you don't, you're probably going to get bounced. And so, you know, I mean, the safety margin, of course, goes up the more you get. But you do have to have more than the minimum.
Well, John's wife ran for judge.
Well,
she went to a place that specializes a law firm.
Oh yeah,
hers got bounced because she didn't have She didn't have her zip code on the thing or some crap.
Yeah, there's also, I mean, you have to be absolutely compliant.
Right.
With, I mean, the rules are, they are not fooling around with that stuff. And so, but the only thing you can do, the only way you can stop this, if you're a party official, is to find somebody else who wants to run for that seat, okay, and essentially force a primary. Well, that, you know, in a third party, that gets kind of hard, right? So if you can't pull that off, the only other action you can take as a party is to you can disavow a candidate. You can not give them any money, not give them any help, and publicly say, this guy sucks.
Yeah.
But you, because you have a free speech right to do that, but you can't stop him from running as a candidate on your ticket.
All right.
And that's just the way it works.
So how do you,
so that's what we did.
Okay, but if you're running for, sorry to interrupt, but if you're the party guy, or certainly if you're the incumbent, you don't need the signatures to get on the ballot. How do they decide who needs them and who doesn't?
Well, it's so generally speaking, if you're an incumbent, you don't, generally speaking. The other thing is that in Florida, and it's every state is different, but in Florida, you can buy your way on the ballot without having to collect petitions.
That's so American. It's,
well, and so basically, yeah, well, third parties and people who are trying to challenge typically don't have that kind of dough. Right.
Right.
But the incumbent just forks up $25,000 or whatever the number is and says, you know, have a nice day. And so it's not like, you know, okay, here's $500. It's a substantial amount of cash. but you have to, you know, that's the other option. And like I said, every state's different, but Florida.
Well, Illinois, I mean, the Democrat and Republican presidential candidates, they're greased on. If you want to be a third party, you got to do some serious work.
Well, that is because of ballot access generally, which is it's been one of the Libertarian Party's issues, you know, forever, as is any other third party.
Have they ever made it on all 50 states?
Yeah.
It was only once, wasn't it?
No, I believe it's happened a few times. I think we had all 50 when I was on the EC.
Did Russ Perot didn't get 50? Did he?
I don't know, but Gary Johnson, I believe, did. I think he was running when I was on the EC, and I think we had all 50 states. It didn't do it. You know, I mean, it didn't matter.
Where do these parties come up with? I know I'm grabbing you off your thing here, but whenever you talk, you give me a bunch of questions, so it's your fault, not mine. But how do you get to like the Water Reclamation District? And there's three people on there from the Green Party, and then there's a couple other of the Cook County positions. There's a Green Party person, but there's nobody running for state's attorney. There's nobody running for anything. I won't say meaningful, because those are meaningful jobs. But how do you get three people to get petitions for the Metropolitan Senator? I mean, they have any chance of winning? How many? They got to slug themselves to a bad day getting petitions for that? What's the point?
Well, that's, I mean, the same kind of thing. You know, my district in Florida, we had the same sort of thing happen with representative, with, you know, U.S. representatives, if you weren't a Republican. The Democrats always ran somebody, but it was a waste of time because there was a 60-point margin for, I mean, it was ridiculous. Okay, so, I mean, there was, it wasn't really a contest. I mean, technically it was a contest, but in reality it was not a contest. And that's, you know, it's just the way it works. So, there's so much of this kind of stuff that goes on, but the thing is, as a result of this, I did a lot of reporting on this whole situation when the Martin case was going on, a ton of it, and including analyzing video evidence that was out in the public, the media, when Zimmerman was first nabbed, he was arrested. Of course, you know, I mean, he shot a guy, all right? So, I mean, you know, we're going to investigate and see what's going on.
Well, if he played middle linebacker, it'd be okay.
Well, you know, I mean, but his claim at the time was that, you know, that there had been a fight, that Martin jumped him, essentially, knocked him down, and was bashing his head against a concrete sidewalk, and that was when he pulled his gun and shot him.
I might have done that too.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if you get
except
your head bashed,
except I don't have a gun.
Well, I'm saying if you got your head bashed against a concrete sidewalk, there's a pretty good chance you're going to be dead, right?
Yeah.
So that was his claim. That was his argument of self-defense. So when he was brought in, they, you know, of course, the cop shop has cameras all over the place, right? So, you know, they've got him bringing him in. The local news station stuck their logo over his head as he was being walked up a stairway. And when I got that back out, because, you know, you got video tools, you take it back out, you could clearly see the back of his head had been injured. There was blood coming down it. Now, if you get in a fight with somebody and it's a fist fight, you don't get punched in the back of the head, okay?
Well, unless you duck and he misses.
That probably don't happen, no. Right? So, I mean, so there was physical evidence that he wasn't lying about what had originally happened. The media claimed he was, that basically he just, you know, pulled gun, shot the guy. And Pam Bondi fabricated evidence of someone who was allegedly his girlfriend that was not. And the corruption in that case was off the rack.
How come nobody ever does that to us? Give us alleged girlfriends we don't have.
Well, you know, but if you don't really have them, then what good does that do you, right? Because you can get anything.
Well, yeah.
There's a problem, right? But the thing, I mean, basically, they whitewashed all the bad stuff and tried to create this narrative that he was this poor black kid that this white guy shot. Now, Zimmerman, of course, was not a white guy. Zimmerman was Hispanic, okay, which made it even worse. So, I mean, this was a huge scandal at the time. Now this woman has replaced Matt Gaetz as the AG nominee, and there is a rumor floating around that I can't validate at this point, that when Gaetz was shopping his nomination, you know, and you work the Senate, right? Because that's where you got to go get confirmed. That he was basically told, here's a list of people you can't go after, and one of them was Fauci.
Really?
And if you don't agree to this, here's nine Republican senators that are going to vote against you, and you're screwed.
There's an undercurrent of something, Carl. I mean,
I don't know what the whole bargain is here, right? What the quid pro? But as I have pointed out, if Trump is actually going to get anything done, he needs to do two things. He needs to do a couple of things immediately, which he can do by executive order. One of them is he has to start going after people with 8 U.S.C. 1324 on the illegals thing. And by the way, Holman has said publicly he will use that law and he will refer charges against sanctuary city mayors and governors, which, by the way, he has every legal right to do.
Are they going to check out the greenskeepers at Mar-a-Lago?
Well, you know what? Apparently, those greenskeepers are all going to be gone because otherwise people are going to start going to jail. But here's the thing, all right? So, you know, we just had the trial for the guy that now can say, because he's sitting in jail, he's convicted, killed Lake and Riley. Okay. Lake and Riley, her murderer, Ibarra, not only came into the United States illegally, got caught, was paroled, went to New York, and then on the state's dime was flown to Athens in Georgia. Now, that is squarely within the parameters of 8 U.S.C. 1324. You paid to transport this guy knowing he was an illegal alien. By the way, he killed somebody. He's been convicted. That is a life sentence for everybody who assisted him.
Well, we can't give anybody any. What you mentioned the thing.
Well, you better start, because if Trump does not do this, okay. And then the other thing that he needs to do is in Health and Human Services, and you know he's now nominated, Dr. Oz. A lot of people are snickering about that one because the guy's he's kind of a televangelist of medicine, so to speak, right? But he did
run for senator, and he is a doctor. I mean,
well, he is. He's not just a doctor; he's a cardiothoracic surgeon.
Okay, I'm saying out of all the people, I'm just stuck up there. He could be one of the most qualified. I mean,
well, in terms of chops, yeah. Right? I mean, they're there, right? I mean, you may snicker at what he did with his life.
I'm going to say the Defense Department guy is 1/100th as qualified as Lou.
Yeah, okay, so there you go. But here's the
thing.
Hey,
we mentioned something yesterday. I want to bring this up before we go to break.
Yeah.
As usual, and when I say as usual, when I was young, I was young once, people used to tell me stuff about people in Washington and conventions and rules and the way people behaved.
Right.
And I actually sort of believed it. And yet, I think I realize now that it's not really rules, or if they're rules, I'll go back to one of my buddies. I said, hey, you know, this is when I first started, wasn't going on the air yet, but so what is the story with people who are representatives and senators? He goes, you don't want that job. I go, he goes, what do you mean? He goes, well, there was a guy, Marty Russo. I told you a story about every, well, this whole generation, they're all about 10 years older than me, right? This whole right. generation of people that essentially ran Illinois politics forever.
Oh yeah.
Most of those guys, and I have no idea what the when I was in high school, there was somehow or another we had a constitutional convention in the state of Illinois.
Oh, okay.
And but this I don't see how the hell happened, Carl. Can you imagine this happened today? People running for ConCon, and there was going to be a whole bunch of people. I mean, maybe 100. There was something like that statewide. Might have been more than that. Nobody could run that had ever held any kind of office before. They wanted all new people. I can't imagine a legislature doing that. I don't think it was on a ballot or something. Maybe it was. I was too young. But all these guys now ran. They were all 30 years old, 32, 28. This is where Richie Daley was there,
right.
Marty Russo, all these people. At age 28 or 30, you got to run for something where there wasn't an incumbent coming after you, and you got to see your name on somebody's front lawn, and if you were right. popular, if you're fan, and there was, that became really the new the whole generation of Illinois leadership were all those guys. But anyway, the Marty Russo became our representative when I lived in Evergreen Park when I was growing up, and my buddy says, you know, he doesn't have any money. They're making $25,000 a year, and he keeps two houses.
Right.
Whenever he goes to Beverly to play golf, he can't afford it. You know, all the guys that came out of law school with him that are now working for like a regular law firm are all making even then $85,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year, and he's making $25,000 with two houses. And if you have any kind of stock, you
how's that happening, right?
Yeah, if you had any kind of stock, you had to have put it in a blind trust. And now all of a sudden, that must all have just been gentlemen's agreement. I mean, none of that crap happened. And you mentioned a thing. This guy Gates says he resigned from Congress. Somebody goes, God, what an idiot. Resigned from Congress. And then all of a sudden, you say, well, he didn't resign from his elected 19th. He resigned from the 118th Congress, the one that's only going to last another 3 more weeks. So then, of course, even though I believe you, I start researching it. I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen.
Nobody does, but here's the thing.
Here's what I found here. Let me tell you what I found, and you tell me if I'm wrong. The one article that seemed to make a lot of sense, if he shows up the first day, he'll be the guy. If he doesn't, they'll declare it vacant, and the governor has to do an election. But
the governor's already started scheduling the replacement
right,
election.
But he doesn't. Right. Evidently, if he shows up in Congress day one, he didn't resign from the next one. He said I'm resigning for the 118th or something, but I'm not
right.
And I have no intention of taking my seat. But he if he shows up day one, he's in, according to this article.
Well, legally, he won the election.
Yeah.
Legally he won. Now, he didn't concede the election, which, by the way, if he did that, the Democrat, and I'm sure there was one, I don't know who it was, but there was a Democrat candidate that was on the ballot, okay? So if he was to concede the election, the seat would flip, which is not going to happen.
No.
All right? So, yeah, that's not going to happen. I mean, you know, you'd have someone that lost by 60 points that ends up in the seat. That's not happening.
But evidently the convention is when they take the roll call on day one.
Right.
If he's not there, he's out. If he's there, he's in. How screwed up is that?
Well, but now here's the thing.
This is one article now. That could not be the
well, no, I believe legally you're right, because I have looked at this. Okay, I believe legally that's the correct interpretation. Now, here's the thing, though. The leadership, the House Leadership Conference, since the Republicans are going to be in the minority, otherwise it would be the minority conference, so, you know, for the Democrats that take seats. They determine committee assignments. So if the House leadership does not like this and thinks this is just one level of sleaze too far, okay,
It did say that he lost his seniority because he resigned.
Well, I understand that, but the thing is that they could turn around and they could strip all of his committee assignments.
Like I said, I don't think he has a seniority. They have to.
No, he does it well, but he could be reappointed to them with or without the seniority because that.
He's going to be the end of the bench, though. If he was,
The leadership in each of the conferences has almost complete authority to put anybody on or off those committees that they want.
Okay, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying if I work my way through the pick up agriculture committee. And I'm on it for 8 years, and all of a sudden I'm the second or third ranking guy, and I pull this kind of crap like he did. I'm coming back as the lowest ranking guy, correct?
Well, you do, but the point is you're still on the committee.
Right, but now I'm not even close to being chairman.
No, okay. You're thinking of a union labor world where seniority controls pretty much everything, and you know you get to be foreman because you have 10 years on the job or whatever. Politics doesn't quite work like that.
But it used to work like that a lot.
Well, it sort of does, but it kind of doesn't. Okay, what you'd think would happen doesn't necessarily have to because, again, the leadership of the... This is the thing about a collegial body. They get to make their own rules within the broad outlines of Roberts. And, oh, by the way, committee assignments is not one of those things that has a controlling chapter. So, no.
We're going to go to break in a minute here. But here's a question to maybe ponder over break. This sounds like such a stupid thing to say. Who's really in charge? What I'm saying is, you're right. It's not just a rote sort of thing. I think you're right. But also, there are somebody somewhere is in charge for these really deep committees like the covert actions overseas, that kind of thing. People that are informed of that stuff. Somebody somewhere identifies, in other words, if somebody like Lou got elected, he might be a freshman representative, but somebody's going to say, hey, wait a minute, this guy is a cut above in this area. We need him on this. Same thing happened here to Mike Quigley, my guy.
Right.
Because Mike is a real bright guy. But he was on the double secret, whatever, clandestine military stuff committee in his second or third term. It wasn't like he just was there forever. There's some guys that are there forever and never come close to something like that. I guess my question: who makes that call to say, "Wait a minute"? You know, Carl's been there five terms, but so what? The guy's a bumble bleep. This other guy here knows everything about. We're going to put him up above Carl. And who gets to do that?
That's the leadership of the conference. So in this case, it would
But is it Democrat Republican or even the Democrats?
It's party specific, Chief. The party heads choose their committee members, and so the Republicans being in the majority have a majority of committee seats in each committee.
Okay,
but the party chiefs choose the membership, so they can bounce you off a committee if they don't like you. They can throw you out. It's one of the ways you can be punished for doing things without being formally censured, and there's really no vote. You have absolutely nothing you can do about it if the speaker or the minority leader does this. If Hakeem Jeffries does this to a Democrat, there's nothing that Democrat can do about it.
Okay, because I'm looking here.
The only thing you can do is try to bounce him as the chair, as the minority, okay, or as the speaker in the case of the majority leader. You can try to bounce that person, but you know you have to go through the procedure to do that. That was what led to McCarthy getting bounced, was that he did some things that the conference was pissed off enough about that they were able to get enough votes to force that resolution. This is a privileged resolution to put that on the floor, and they were able to force enough votes to get that on the floor.
once you do that, then the game's, now we've got to go through a whole other organizational, you know, set of votes in order to elect a new chair or a new minority leader. And the same thing happens. So that, but that is your only, your only way to counteract something like that, is you can try to mount a, you know, removal of your leadership.
Well, he was on the, we're going to go to break, I promise. House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. That's not something that you put some Dumbo on, I don't think.
Well, you'd hope not.
No, you would hope. What do you say we go to break? We'll be right back. SP Futures down 3, NASDAQ Futures down 30. We're not doing very much. Stocks that had earnings last night, NTAP is up 9. The Gap is up 471. It's 21%. That's a big move for the Gap. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 6, NASDAQ Futures down 42. We've been slightly down most of the day, but yesterday, just as a way of review, we will... yesterday, the Dow was up 461, a couple stocks that were really up in there. S&P was up 31, NASDAQ only up 6, and NASDAQ was the dragger yesterday. Today, we're all down a little bit here. In Europe, the machine's a little slow. DAX up 88.5%, FTSE up 84, it's a full 1%. CAC around up 18.2. Euro stocks higher as investors assess weak PMI data. Euro slumps to 2-year low. So we got dollar moving around again, which causes some of this stuff. Nikkei up 257.7%. Hang Seng down 371. It's almost 2%. Shanghai down 103. That's 3%. Asia markets mostly rise, but China stocks falter. Investors assess Japan inflation, Singapore GDP, blah, blah. Bonds down 4 basis points, 4.39. The Bund down 6 basis points, 2.25. Japan down 2 basis points, 1.07. We have oil down 57 cents, back under 70 bucks, 69.53. Brent down 57 cents, 73.66. Natural gas down 16 cents, 3.17. Arbob down a penny, 2.04. Gold up again, up 21 bucks, almost back to 2,700, 26.96. Almost making the full return from 27.50 down to 25.50 now, almost all the way back. Silver up 25 cents, 31.19. Copper down 3 cents, 4.08. Foreign exchange, and this is where the game has been. We're under 105. We're 104 in this euro. When we come back, we're going to talk to Carl about what that means. And most, it's really hard to get a feel on what a 5 or 6% move in a currency means until you have some idea of how much these transactions take place on a daily basis. British pound 125. That's not moving as much as the euro. Crypto down 109, but still 98,147. Why do people complain like me that individual stocks are overvalued when we got a stock that has no income, no anything that's overvalued? Well, that's about it. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:37 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. We're looking at 41 degrees right now with a high of 47. Mostly cloudy, breezy, and milder. So now it might be breezy. Otherwise, it's going to be low clouds. Let's go to Phoenix, Arizona. 51 degrees right now with a high of 81. Partly sunny. And tonight will be clear with a low of 48 degrees. Traffic in Chicago is looking pretty good so far. Inbound Kennedy from Monroe's 33 minutes. 49 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 37 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 22 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 35 minutes. Lastly, sports. Today in the NBA, the Bulls play the Hawks at 7 p.m. NFL Week 12 is here. Yesterday, the Browns beat the Steelers 24-19. That was a pretty good game. This Sunday, we have Vikings at Bears at 12 p.m. and Cardinals at Seahawks at 3:25 p.m. Lastly, NHL, Blackhawks beat Panthers 3-1 yesterday. Back over to you, Chief.
So, Carl, what lost in the God knows what else, politics and market and everything else, this is one hell of a move in the dollar. What What do you make of it? And what businesses are hurt by it? What's the? I should know this. What is it? People talk about the stock market trading during the day, and it's an awful lot of money.
Right.
It's nowhere near the currency moves on a daily basis. I mean, 5% in a currency is, that's a whole year, and it's happened in 2 weeks.
Yeah, this is rather interesting what you're seeing with with that whole change, if you will. And I'm kind of, the dollar situation to me is, as I pointed out, one of the problems that has been around for quite some period of time is that we have had this premise of the U.S. dollar being the trade currency of choice, right? And this is why we've gotten away with the inflationary things that we've done for as long as we did.
Well, plus everybody else doing the same thing, which helped out.
Well, no, it's really kind of a little more basic than that, Chief. If you and I are transacting across the national boundary, it takes time for that transaction, from when you order something until I deliver it to you. Okay, quite a long time,
right,
frequently.
Oh, yeah.
Because I got to make it, I got to put it on a ship. This is a couple of months long process. It's not like ordering something from Amazon where it shows up in 3 days. So during that period of time, once you place the order and I start producing it, I have to have a reasonable belief that I'm not going to have my margin destroyed by changes in the currency over that period. Because if it does, I'm out of business. I'm done. So I have to have some reasonable belief that that's not going to happen.
Or you need a forward contract.
Well, and, yes, I can hedge these things. There's things you can do, right? But the reality is that risk is always there. And I would prefer to take it off the table if I can. I got enough problems dealing with actually just managing to get the product made and out the door, right? I don't need to add this exogenous event to
the
list.
Well, it's the same thing as why people hedge corn on the farmer's side and Kellogg's side.
Right. Right, same basic thing, right? So, but we, and this, so if I go from $1 trillion in trade flows in a year to $1.1 trillion in trade flows in a year, so that's plus $100 billion, okay? During the time that those trade flows are in transit, there's $100 billion of dollars that is impounded effectively. From an economics point of view, that means that the Treasury in the United States can run $100 billion worth of deficit spending and not have it show up in prices. And as long as the trade flows continue to expand, the amount, not the total dollar amount, but the amount of expansion accrues to the government entity, the country, that is that preferred choice. All right, and it accrues to their benefit, and they can use that for deficit spending and not have the inflation turn around and whack their consumers, their citizens. Well, when the Ukraine-Russia thing started and we started sanctioning God and anybody that had, any plausible contact with Russia, whether they were actually involved in the shooting or not, all of a sudden you had the people in the international trade business looking at this going, look, you owe me $100,000 for this container ship full of blue jeans. The federal government might seize that $100,000 and not just tax it, but seize it. Well, if they do, I'm out of business because I had to spend the money in order to make the blue jeans, and you got the blue jeans and I didn't get paid. And I'm never going to get paid because the government stole the money. And that risk is something that I can avoid by demanding you pay me in my own currency, whatever that is. So it's Bangladesh dollars or whatever Bangladesh uses, or Vietnam or whatever have you. But Vietnam, I guess their currency is the dong or something like this.
Well, I don't know.
So I say, I know, what a weird name, right? So I say, well, I want to be paid in my currency because even though there's a trade risk there, in terms of currency balance and things, it's less than the possibility that the federal government, the U.S. federal government, is going to turn around and steal all of it, steal 100%. And so pay me in mind. Well, that shift is why when we did all this stuff after the first year or so of COVID, when Biden came into office and the Ukraine-Russian dust-up started essentially immediately thereafter, and so did the sanctions, that is the reason that all of that deficit spending that Biden did instantly showed up in the inflation that you see it as a consumer in America, and yet all the inflationary
it's also the lag time from.
Well, I understand that, but here's the other the thing though, Chief, is it's still going on, and the thing is, it's the reason that Trump for 3.5 years pretty much got away with it.
That's why he's saying there was no inflation on his watch because there's a lag to it.
Well, no, there's also no. He also said there's no inflation on his watch because legitimately a large part of it was absorbed by trade balance.
But a lot of it just never got out. I guess.
Well, it never got out into the consumer. Okay.
Okay. No.
But now that
you brought this up, let me ask
Chief,
you.
That era is over.
Okay, but now that you brought this up, let me bring out a simple question.
Yeah.
When I was in grad school, and you know where I was, University of Chicago, the hotbed of monetary theory, right?
Right.
When people increased or decreased the money supply, you know, you're going to put more in to stimulate the economy, or you're going to pull some out to back up the economy, whatever you're going to do. It was usually in increments of maybe a half of 1% or 1% or something. I mean, we're talking about interest rate moves.
Right.
So it was, even if you shoved money into the economy, it was some number to get you from 6% to 5.25% or something. It was there was some size of rate of the water going in the pool that people made assessments on. I'm saying this wrong, I know, but help me here. But then it was, okay, how long did that take before it worked its way through the system and actually showed up on people spending more, maybe in a little bit of inflation, maybe spending less if we're going the other way. How long did it take to work its way through and have an effect? And the number was always, almost wrote out of every student's mouth, even mine, it was like 6 months. But that's like saying if you hit somebody pretty hard, how long does it take for the bruise to heal? And they'll say, well, it probably takes a week. All right, if you're playing touch football and all of a sudden you got a bruise on your forearm. Well, if somebody really whacks you, then all of a sudden it's not. In other words, within the six-month number, there was some sort of an assumption of what level of activity you were doing. Is that a way to put it? So during the Trump administration, and I'm not pinning it all on him, with the COVID and everything, we increased the money supply by 40% in an 18-month period. It's never been done before. The only way that's ever seen anything like that was in the bank panic of 1932, where the money supply dropped by 40% in 18
months.
So I'm going to say that there's no way that the economy can absorb that amount of cash in the 6 month that I would have given the answer to when I was in grad school. I think it's still happening, Carl, that amount of dough being in it. I mean, I think we still have, and the weird part is people look at, and if you were to take Rick Santelli, who I think is a good guy, and you were to say, God, the dollar is getting its ass kicked, the first thing he's going to say, and why I said it earlier in the show, what do you mean? Against the euro, it's actually like going up, or against the pound. If they do the same thing, if we all coordinate during COVID and we all pour money into the system, it's not going to show up there. What's going to show up is, wait a minute, the IBM used to be 150, now it's 208.
Right.
The price of that car used to be 30, now it's 45. It's the value of the dollar versus all the other stuff. When people start to think it's another currency. But what we were talking about, Carl, we got off topic as usual with me, is for an individual company, my stepfather was in the, remember Waltham Watches and Hallmark Rings? Hallmark Rings,
yeah.
You probably did. I don't think Waltham Watch is still around, but he was a controller, VP of finance of that company. And they bought all the movements from Switzerland and assembled them here, like what you call a factory, but it actually was like an office building over right here by Clinton, 300 South Clinton. Right here, you know, I could see it out the window of my office. But they assembled the watches there. But they put the order in for Christmas watches, like you said, May or something? and you expected those things to be delivered.
Right.
The inner parts, maybe August, September. You put them all together, put them in the nice, you know, you put the, you had the what do you call the outside of the watch? The band were all, they were here. So you stuck the movement in there, you put the thing in there, you screwed it on, and you had a watch, right? Well, these currency fluctuations, if you priced your whole system, actually this year they'd be making out like a bandit. Because if they priced their whole line of watches, and I don't know where the hell I got the diamonds from, but the watches were the easy ones. They all came from Switzerland. They would be 5% to the good now, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's...
But if it went the other way...
But it went the other way, they might be out of business.
Matter of fact, the dollar was going down, and he had just had his stroke, right? And I'm driving to work every day. And every time the news came on, they were talking about the dollar getting its ass kicked. This had to be in the 70s, because I think I was in grad school. The dollar's getting its ass kicked every day, because we're pouring money into the system to pay for the Vietnam War and blah, blah, blah. So they're talking about, guys got on there talking about speculators that are driving the price. And so my stepfather, the bank calls him up and says, hey, you guys are kind of in trouble. You better hedge this dollar, because the Swiss franc's going to be worth so much more 2 months from now when you pay for these things that you guys are going to, you're going to blow your whole, you know, the whole margin on your watches. So they would buy these foreign contracts. One day I looked at him, I go, you're one of the dirty speculators.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he was, right? He essentially was saying, the dollar's going down. I'm going to buy this forward contract because I don't want to hurt my business, which is essentially saying he was. It's the same as if he actually was buying the francs early, which is really what he was doing, right?
Yeah, that's essentially, you know, I mean, that is the essence of how all this ends up working out. I mean, it's the thing is, though, is that what we have to understand. This is, and this, by the way, is where Yellen is an absolute lunatic.
What do you mean? She's okay. Bought and paid for.
Well, okay.
I don't think she's a lunatic at all. She's got $7.5 million.
How about corrupt as hell? Is that?
She's got $7.5 million in her pocket, and I don't.
Well, there you go. Yeah, you have a point there. Yeah. So, I don't either, by the way, because I didn't manage to grift the correct people in order to get it right. So, here's the problem with this, though. These crazies. In the last month of the campaign, in October, as I pointed out last week, now that we have the MTS out, these nut jobs threw $500 billion of printed credit into the economy in the first 3 weeks of the fiscal year, okay, in October. Now...
Well, the money supply is back on its 6% growth rate.
Well, okay, and by the way... year over year comparisons, hospital payments under CMS were up a double, and Part B, which is physician payments, 250% of last year's levels. The total in CMS across all of CMS's internal components was up like 57% or something like that. Which is the bulk of this, by the way, this $500 billion, is by far the largest component, was right there in CMS. Now this is year over year comparisons against October 2020,
and I'm going to say, Carl, that the care of people that I know that are sick,
they got nothing.
Is way worse than it was.
I'm just saying they got nothing out of that. Okay, all of this was grifted off and shoved in people's pockets and bought them a new Bentley. So. The problem, though, with this is, of course, the inflationary impact, as I pointed out when we first saw this spending level, showed up in the debt to the penny immediately, of course. The inflationary impact is going to hit the U.S. economy starting in about January, February of next year, because that's the lag time.
And
right?
Don't think for a second that Trump and his group are going to try and prick this wealth bubble. They're part.
Oh, I'm not saying anybody's going to. Nobody. He's not going to intentionally try to prick it, but it's going to find a pin.
Yeah, well, I think it will. But
that's how bubbles are.
Well, speaking of which, I without getting into it over Bitcoin and people love the thing and it goes up. If you're making money on it, I mean, when Jan and I were on the score and we had this huge listenership, and I could have said. Call me up today and buy, you know, turtle eggs from Zimbabwe. They're going to the moon, and people, they don't even know what turtle eggs are, right?
They buy it anyway.
They buy it anyway. But, I mean, this, the Bitcoin, is you're justified because it's going up. Yesterday, we talked, I don't know if you were listening, but was it Russell said, that would have been Wednesday, we're up to $1.8 trillion in value of just the Bitcoin. What happens if that thing falls? I mean, can those people, I mean, all the people in Puerto Rico that moved down there because they have Bitcoin, all they do is congratulate themselves, right? What happens to Puerto Rico? Those guys move.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, you know, you want to talk about completely stupid. You look at it, MicroStrategy, which essentially at this point is a Bitcoin holding company, right? I mean, for all intents and purposes, its market cap is like double the value of the coins it has. Now, explain to me how that makes any sense. They don't do anything else.
I thought they had some kind of company. They don't do anything anymore?
Oh, well, they do, but in terms of, you know, a reason for that sort of valuation doesn't exist.
But I think somebody said that yesterday, and didn't the stock go way down and came right back up?
Well, yeah, I mean, look.
What is that, MSTR?
Right, but, MSTR. By the way, they are the company that very plausibly was the reason for the crash in 2000, was that they had an earnings restatement. They found funny business in their financials. They did a restatement, which, now, whether or not it was actually them, I don't know. Nobody does, right? I mean, it's just the psychology shifted at that particular moment. But it shifted that day, okay, in a seriously negative way. And the thing that's interesting about it was that they were, you know, they were dog crap little company at the time. I mean, yeah, okay, they were NASDAQ listed, but they weren't, you know, like in the top, they weren't one of the Magnificent Seven, so to speak, right, of the time. I mean, you know, those were the Ciscos and the stuff like this. But literally the day they did that was the day that the market started to blow up, when it blew up in everybody's face. And I was house hunting at the time, and I woke up and I turned on CNBC and the
NASDAQ. These guys were $50 a year ago, and now they're 402.
Yeah, the NAS was way down, and I just chuckled and went back to sleep. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, here we go. And as it turned out, yeah, here we go.
Well, they borrowed money to buy this stuff, right?
Right. Well, essentially, it's a leverage farm using it to, and they keep issuing more paper to buy more bitcoins into the increasing price.
Who's buying the paper? What kind of interest are they paying the paper?
Look, if you told me, if you tried to solicit me to buy paper for the you know, for this company to do, I'd look at you like you had six heads.
I bet they're paying big number. Well, allegedly.
I don't know. I mean, but obviously,
well, you're not going to give them to them for 3%. But at 10, you're going to say, hey, it's a big company. 10% is cool, but 10% is a little wobbly if stuff ever goes down, right?
Well, but yeah, if it ever blows up in your face, it's, you know, the reason you got 10% is because it's worth zero, right? So yeah, I mean, I look at all this and I just. Where does it blow? I do not know when it blows, okay? But, I mean, you know, I look at this thing with SMCI and the thing with NVIDIA and, you know, and all I heard, I looked at the, you know, listened to the earnings call and, you know, all the stuff that NVIDIA put out. All they're saying is, oh, you know, these hyperscalers are all, we have a strong order flow, we have a strong backlog, you know, data, you know, all the things you want to hear, right? But I always ask the same question. Who's making money? Who's actually turning revenue with this thing that exceeds the cost of buying the stuff and powering it and putting in data centers and running it and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? And the answer, as far as I can tell, is nobody at the present time. Now, that doesn't mean somebody won't in the future.
As long as you get people to give you money to keep going, you don't care.
Chief, we did the same thing with Rhythms and North Point with DSL lines in the 1990s.
Oh, yeah. They were
going to be the way that everybody connected the internet because it was cheaper and it was going to beat cable, okay? The company, every one of them was soliciting me to almost on a daily basis to partner with them. And I kept looking at the numbers and I said, the only reason you guys are in business is that you keep being able to sell paper to get more cash, because every one of these circuits that you put in that goes to a customer's house, you lose money on. And the problem with this is, if I partner with you and I've got your rack sitting in my data center in order to do this, if you blow up, 5,000 of my customers get disconnected. And by the way, I can't just call up one of your competitors and say, oh, move it over to this guy.
Well,
that's not how it works.
No, I mean, but this isn't new that people. I mean, hell, the dad bomb. And I remember I was on, I don't know if it was on CNBC or someplace, and I go, the guy goes, well, it's all on click throughs to other places. You don't make any money, really, on what you're selling. I said, so if you take that to the extreme, if I walked into Marshall Fields, there still was a Marshall Fields, and nobody would care if they made any money on perfume. What if I look up and there's 100 banners from the ceiling of advertisements of other places? I go, I don't think that's necessarily a business model. Don't you have to make money on what you're doing?
by the way, on X, while we're talking, apparently Allianz, you know, the German insurance company, bought about a quarter of MicroStrategy's 2031 bond. Do you want to know who's sitting on the bomb? The ticking grenade. It'd be them.
Does it say there on what the interest rate is?
No.
Bet it's high.
Yeah, you think? But you know, I mean, all this game works, as you know, turning the crank like this works as long as the price.
Carl, didn't right? I mean, I do the show, but you listen in, and while I'm talking, maybe I'm not remembering. Didn't Kenny Pulcheri tell us once that? I'm going to say it might have been during COVID that he, when they first started lending people money on margin to buy the, wasn't he saying he was making 1% a month? He didn't send them very much. Well, I mean, it wasn't send them like $1 million. He probably sent them like 20 grand or something, just be part of the, he just wanted to see what the whole, I don't know if he sent it to Coin or, I'm not going to throw a name, well, I just did, but I don't think it was the guy who went to jail. It was some outfit that was starting to give people margin for Bitcoin, and
yeah, I mean, I just you know, I,
but
just,
I think he was 1% a month. Didn't he say that?
That sounds crazy, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds like a lot, especially because what was the interest rate at the time? Like zero.
I mean, I look at things like this and go, excuse me.
Yeah, it's.
But I, you know, I mean, we.
But,
have
you,
so
but you can't pick the day, though. It's impossible to pick.
No,
the day.
You can't. But the idea, you know, what I see coming, and you know, and I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen, but the idea that we're going to get into and you know materially into Trump's term, okay. And they're just going to keep doing this stuff. I mean, you know, Biden is doing everything in his power to throw as much money out on the table as he can. You know, this latest thing he's going
well,
to throw
but I mean,
another,
we got a dash here, but
$60 billion over at Ukraine.
But Trump is also, I mean, his campaign.
Trump's an easy money guy.
Yeah, he's an easy money guy. So if anything, it's not going to get better.
Well, that's exactly the problem. Is if you know, my expectation is he's going to try to double down into this and make it worse.
If you got the dough and you know where it's going to turn, it's like my Mexican friends years ago with they devalued the peso, and the guy says, as long as you know when they're devaluing and you get your pesos offshore that night and bring it back, you're 10% richer than your neighbor.
Yeah, except if neither of you can afford a steak, what's the difference?
Yes. Carl, have a good weekend, buddy. Talk at you next week. We might have to jumble everybody around a little bit because of the Thanksgiving, because I don't want to lose anybody. But your days are okay, Tuesday and Friday.
My days are clean.
Your days are clean. SP futures down 7, NASDAQ futures down 55. Big weekend in college football. We'll see what happens. Carl, I don't know if I ever want to go to another game again, but I wouldn't mind seeing Army play at Yankee Stadium. I might do. I could do that if I had a chance.
Yeah,
it'd be kind of fun.
You know, well, it's there you go. The Vols have that loss away last week is taking a lot of wind out of people's sails around here.
Are they in the top 12 or no?
Well, there's theoretically a way for them to still end up, you know, with playoff and bowl shots, but now they can't lose again, okay? And certain other people have to lose.
But everybody seems like they are losing. They might get there.
Well, it could
happen. I think there's a chance Indiana gets spanked at Ohio State.
Well, believe me, this last loss hurt.
Yeah.
So it was not one that you wanted to have happen, and it did. And yeah, they do amazing things at Neyland, but when they're away, they just kind of can't put it together.
Then again,
so.
your buddy, what was a big coach? He was on TV forever. Tell us his name. The Oakland guy. You know what I'm talking about, John. the coach, he had the John Madden.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Madden. Yeah.
Venue never won a football game.
Yeah, well.
Anyway, on that note, have a nice weekend, bud.
Yeah, you too.
SP Futures down 6, NASDAQ Futures down 49. We'll see what happens today. Talk about it on Monday, Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.